and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the UAA APU Consortium Library for Dr. Eugenie Scott's lecture on the evolution of creationism. Dr. Eugenie Scott holds her doctorate in physical anthropology from the University of Missouri, and she is executive director of the National Center for Science Education. Her talk on the evolution of creationism was recorded in Anchorage on January 27th.
In a situation like this, what I would ordinarily say is, thank you, what a lovely large audience to come out on such a cold night. Oh, wait. They're all cold. But you are a lovely, nice audience, and thank you for coming out on a dark night. Oh, wait. But I'm very glad to be. I actually grew up in Wisconsin and Minnesota, so I'm not that much of a hothouse flower, even though I now live in California and I'm a total weather wimp. But it's nice seeing snow again. I'm having a good time here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm really glad to be here. Well, I'm here to talk tonight about the evolution of creationism, because the creation and evolution controversy is one that has a singular presentation in the United States, shall we say. Let me just, because this is an academic audience, let me just show you a little bit of poll data. This is an article from Science Magazine from 2006, Miller, Scott, and Okamoto. Don't try to read it, you'll go blind. The question that we asked in this survey of nations, humans evolved from earlier forms of animals, true or false? And I'll blow up that diagram, that chart from the picture. The blue is, yes, yellow is not sure, and the red is, disagree. And if you want to know where we are, we beat Turkey. Now, this is 2006, so, maybe things have gotten better in the last few years. 2006 was a few years ago. Well, in 2009, the British Council conducted a survey across a number of nations. They asked a question, among others, enough scientific evidence exists to support Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. We beat Egypt. This is not good. This is not good that the United States is close to the bottom on what scientists would consider a basic measure of science literacy. If you contrast the low acceptance of evolution among Americans in general with the acceptance of evolution among scientists, it becomes even more striking. The Pew Foundation conducted a survey of members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the largest science association in the world. It has over 120,000 members. They asked, humans and other living things have evolved over time. 97% of scientists agreed with that. In this survey, 61% of the general public. A much higher percentage, by the way, than you find in most of the other surveys. But the differential between the scientists and the general public is what I want to point your attention to. There is a disconnect here between members of the general public, the science community, and most other developed countries, and even a large number of developing countries. So let's talk just a little bit about this idea of evolution that seems to be so controversial in our country. First of all, I'd like to make the point that evolution is not what most people think it is. Evolution is a very basic idea that cuts across all sciences. You ask most people, what is evolution? It's man evolved from monkeys. Well, it's a little more than that. Astronomy is an evolutionary science. Geology is an evolutionary science. Biology is an evolutionary science, and so is anthropology. And all of these fields, you are dealing with a cumulative change through time. Now, obviously, what astronomers study and what geologists study and biologists and anthropologists, they're studying different things, they're using different techniques, they're using different understandings of the science, but they're all dealing with the basic idea that the universe has had a history. That if you were able to go back in time far enough, you would find different galaxies, different planet Earth, different plants and animals on the surface, different human cultures in the case of anthropology. There has been a cumulative change through through time. Now, you ask most Americans, what is evolution? It's man evolved from monkeys. And of course, if you ever want to drive physical anthropologists crazy, confuse monkeys and apes. There's a difference between monkeys and apes. They are not the same kind of varmints. And the actual relationship between these three organisms is that we and chimpanzees shared a common ancestor fairly recently. And our branch, the human-chimp branch, shared a common ancestor with monkeys further back in time. What evolution is really about, biological evolution is really about, is shared ancestry. Common ancestry with other living things, including, of course, monkeys and apes, but also petunias and bacteria and every other living thing on the planet. I'm going to talk about the history of the creationism and evolution controversy and how Americans ended up with this unusually skeptical view of evolution, which, as I say, scientists accept very widely. I want to recommend two very good sources if you're interested in the history of this controversy, and I find it fascinating. I mean, in addition to my own book, but you know, mostly I get what I know about the history from Ronald Numbers and Ed Larson. Both of these books, Summer of the Gods by Ed Larson and Ron Numbers, The Creationists, are excellent sources for understanding this problem. Well, the history of the creationism and evolution controversy can roughly be divided into three periods, corresponding with three creationist strategies. The first period, creationists attempted to simply ban the teaching of evolution, to outlaw it. The heyday of this period was between about 1919 and about 1925, and this was, of course, the period of the Scopes trial. 1925 is when the Scopes trial took place. This is a photograph from the Scopes trial. William Jennings Bryan on the right, Clarence Darrow on the left, the most famous legal figures of their day. Bryan had run for president three times, was a giant in his day. Bryan gets a rough deal with history. I mean, he's a fascinating historical character, and not nearly the caricature that he is presented in the movie Inherit the Wind, or in the play Inherit the Wind, which is sort of roughly based on the Scopes trial. But actually, the Scopes trial was much more exciting than Inherit the Wind, but nonetheless. Bryan made three general points in his argument, for those of you who don't know what the Scopes trial is. Tennessee passed a law called the Butler Act, which banned the teaching of evolution. John Scopes was a young 25-year-old teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, who was used as the plaintiff. There's a question whether he ever actually taught evolution, but nonetheless, he had substituted for the biology teacher one day. And the city fathers of Dayton thought that because there was this law, this would make a great test case. It would bring a lot of publicity to Dayton. So, you know, basically this was a big publicity stunt, but it turned out to be this hugely historic and important case. But John Scopes was the defendant in the case and the trial in which Darrow and Bryan squared off against each other, one for the defense and one for the prosecution, was about whether John Scopes had taught evolution or not. And Scopes was actually convicted of teaching evolution. He was fined $100, and the case didn't get appealed. So it didn't go anywhere, and the anti-evolution laws stayed on the books. But and that has importance to our understanding of the history of this controversy as well. But during the trial, William Jennings Bryan made three major arguments. One was that evolution is unsupported science, that scientists really felt that evolution didn't have scientific support, that it was just this passing fancy. That evolution was incompatible with religion was the second point. And his third point was that citizens, rather than experts, should determine the curriculum. Scientists and teachers should not determine what should be taught in the public schools. The people who pay the salaries of the teachers should be able to tell the teachers what to teach. Good old American democracy. You know, I've got this image in my mind about the Civil War being taught in the Deep South and in, say, Vermont, where in one place Lee surrenders to Grant and the other Grant surrenders to Lee. I mean, you know, the people who pay he who pays the piper calls the tune, right? And we laugh because it's a silly idea, but, you know, you can go to our YouTube site and you can see The president of the Board of Education of the fine state of Texas, Don McElroy, issuing his proclamation when the science standards were being discussed a couple years ago, somebody's got to stand up to experts. At the National Center for Science Education, which monitors the creationism and evolution controversy, and we try to help people who are struggling with this issue to keep we're on the evolution side, as it were. We're trying to keep evolution in the schools. We have what we refer to as the pillars of creationism. Now, pretty much any argument that a creationist issues in a blog post or a book or a movie or whatever can fall into one of these three categories. And in reading Ed Larson's book, where he talked about these three points that Brian had made, I was struck by how they paralleled what we've for years called the pillars of creationism. One is that evolution is a theory in crisis. That scientists are giving up on evolution. Evolution is not considered scientifically viable. If you were to go to the scientists at this institution or any other institution, they would find that a singular thought. They would wonder what you were talking about. The second pillar of creationism is the idea that evolution and especially Christian religion are incompatible. The dichotomous choice, the idea that you have to choose. You're either a creationist or you accept evolution. And if you're a creationist, you're a good Christian. If you accept evolution, you are therefore ipso facto an atheist. So this dichotomous division of for us or against us is something that's very strongly presented in the creationist literature. And the third pillar is something that is, to me, quite reminiscent of what William Jennings Bryan was talking about, although it's a little bit different. And this is the idea that it's only fair. If you teach evolution, you should balance it with the teaching of something else, like creationism. And in fact, that was the first argument. Well, okay, if you're going to teach evolution, balance it with the teaching of creationism. As I'll discuss, this was eventually replaced with, well, if you're going to teach evolution, balance it with the teaching of something called creation science. And when that didn't work, the argument was made, well, teach evolution, but balance it with the teaching of intelligent design. And where we are today, as eventually I will get through in my discussion here, teach evolution, but balance it with the teaching of the evidence against evolution. And I'll try to show you why those of us who have studied this controversy believe that this is all the same argument. There are similarities running through this entire history, in addition to the similarities between the pillars of creationism and what William Jennings Bryan said. Now, the book that John Scopes taught from, which was a little biology book called Hunter Civil Biology, included evolution, and in fact, most of the books published since 1900 or so in the United States included evolution. 1925, evolution was routinely included in high school biology textbooks. The Scopes trial took place. John Scopes was convicted. And even though it was never appealed and the case never went anyplace, textbook publishers slowly started taking evolution out of textbooks so that, according to Ed Larson, by about 1930, you would be hard-pressed to find evolution in any high school biology textbook. And this remained the case until, believe it or not, the early 1960s, within living memory of many of us. I won't ask you to raise your hands. Evolution didn't return to the high school biology curriculum and textbooks until the science education reforms of the Sputnik era. The Russians beat us into space. This was a terrible assault on the self-image of the United States, which always considered itself superior in science and everything else. And the communists had beat us by getting this artificial satellite to orbit the Earth before we were able to do so. So the National Science Foundation started pouring money into scientific research. Would they do so again? And also into improving science education. And one of the things that they did was appoint committees in physics, chemistry, biology, and earth science to look at the curricular materials and look at the textbooks and see whether and do a better job training teachers and so forth. And the biology committee took a look at the extant high school biology textbooks and were appalled. They threw them out and basically wrote new books from scratch that used inquiry learning, included evolution, included ecology, included sex. Human reproduction was also something that, you know, certainly we don't have to worry about that with high school students. And these books that were produced by these NSF-sponsored committees were very popular. And the commercial publishers started to clone them and put evolution and ecology and human reproduction into their books. And so evolution came back into the curriculum in the 1960s. Now, at around, there still were some of these Scopes era anti-evolution laws on the books, although, you know, the textbooks now included evolution, and so what do we do with these laws? The state of Arkansas had one of these anti-evolution laws, and they were getting ready to use the new textbooks. And they decided that they should do a little tidying of this old silly law that nobody thought was anybody was going to follow anyway. So they asked a 25-year-old high school teacher named Susan Epperson to be the plaintiff for a case that they would bring against the state of Arkansas just to get rid of this law. Because, you know, you've got a law that says you can't teach evolution. You've got textbooks that include evolution. So either you can't use the books or else the teachers break the law in using the books. So this was an untenable situation. Fine, we'll just get rid of the law. Well, it's an interesting history, especially for poor Susan, who was told she'd never have to testify or anything like that. This ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court. And in Epperson versus Arkansas, the Supreme Court struck down the anti-evolution laws such as the Butler Act in Tennessee and the comparable act in Arkansas. Now, why did the Supreme Court strike these laws down? A little bit of background here, a little refreshing your memory. Remember the First Amendment? It has a religion section, and there's two parts to the religion clause. There's the Establishment Clause. No, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and the Free Exercise Clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Taken together, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause mean that public institutions like schools have to be religiously neutral. You cannot advance religion, which is what the Establishment Clause is about. You cannot inhibit religion, which is what the Free Exercise Clause is about. You've got to be religiously neutral. In the Epperson case, what the judge decided, the Supreme Court decided, I should say, is that the law was unconstitutional, the Arkansas law, because it, quote, selects from the body of knowledge a particular segment which it proscribes for the sole reason that it is deemed to conflict with a particular religious doctrine. The reason for these laws was to advance a particular form of Christianity. Therefore, anti-evolution laws were unconstitutional. Now, this was in the late 1960s. Evolution was coming back into the textbooks, therefore it was coming back into the curriculum. It was being taught in schools. And this generated an anti-evolution position, which is still with us today, a position called creation science. Henry Morris is the main person behind creation science. And in the movement that he began, called Scientific Creationism, his book from 1962 is there, is a claim not only that the Bible is historically correct, but that there is scientific evidence to support it. This is the thing that was different about creation science versus what versus the people during John Scopes' time who were objecting to the teaching of evolution. They objected to the teaching of evolution because they believed that, you know, second pillar, they believed that it offended their biblical literalist religious views. Creation science comes along and says, yep, the Bible is literally true. It's 6,000 years old. Creation took place in six 24-hour days, and we can prove this through science. Therefore, give us a place at the table. Therefore, let us be taught in the schools as well. That was the argument of creation science. Now, creation science is based on a Christian theological view called special creationism. And it's based on the idea, of course, that God created, but then all Christians and Jews and Muslims believe that God created. This is about how God creates. Okay, it's not just that God creates, it's that God creates in a particular way that reflects a literal interpretation of the Bible, of Genesis. They believe that God created everything in its present form. So if you look out on at the galaxies, the billions of galaxies, God created them as you see them today. If you look at the planet Earth, God created the planet Earth as you see it today. If you look at the plants and animals on Earth, particularly if you look at the kinds of organisms, the kinds of plants and animals, they are pretty much as God created them today. So pine trees are like God created them, and barnacles are like God created them, and cats and human beings and chimps and monkeys are pretty much, you can have a little bit of variation within the kind, but basically God specially created things as we see them today. It is possible to have a little bit of evolution within the kind, but basically, special creation is just that. And in the most common form of special creationism, God creates all of this at one time in 6 days. In other words, a literal reading of Genesis. Now, that's the most common form of special creation, but you find special creation also in the intelligent design form of creationism, where it's not so much the creation of a pine tree or the creation of a cougar or the creation of a monkey that is important, as it is so much the creation of molecular structures like the bacteria flagellum or the blood clotting cascade or some other kind of complicated structure. The argument, which I'll go into in more detail, that the intelligent design folks make is that these very complicated structures could not occur naturally. They had to have been specially created. They don't mention God, but that's in there. So it is a special creation point of view. When I flip this slide on, I can see all of you. You may not know that. I can see all of you. When I put the slide on, there were two individuals who started giggling. My guess is that they are cell biologists, because that is a little model of how the bacteria flagellum works, of the little engine of the rotor motor. And a cell biologist would know that actually it goes like, the flagellum goes like this. It doesn't undulate. I got it from a creationist site, what can I say? You do the best you can in this job. Now, creation science reflects this biblical literalist theology, like I said, but remember, their argument is that they can support biblical literalism through science. They're very concerned about the age of the earth. A lot of the creation science arguments deal with the age of the earth and how it is very young. And of course, if it's young, there's no time for evolution. So this is a very important component of creation science. Catastrophic geology is really at the heart of creation science because of this necessity. If gradual geological processes are responsible for building up mountains or wearing down mountains and creating valleys and canyons and stuff, then there's also enough time for evolution. If catastrophic processes can produce all of the geological features on the planet, then there's no time for evolution and they win. So the flood of Noah is something that's very important in creation science. The Colorado Plateau is a very well-studied geological feature. Geologists love it. It's beautiful, but it also has really great rocks. And this is a diagram from the creationist literature. And I have enhanced it a little bit so you can read it a little bit better. The pre-flood and the early flood pretty much explain the lower portions of the Colorado Plateau, in which, where you find Grand Canyon, by the way, and the rest of the Colorado Plateau had been laid down by late flood and post-flood. Now, think about what you're looking at here. In Grand Canyon alone, you're dealing with over a mile of sediment. The whole Colorado Plateau is a couple of miles of sediment. All of this sediment, the hundreds of thousands of independent, identifiable layers that you find throughout this vast geological feature of the Colorado Plateau, all of this rock and sand and gravel and shale and limestone and siltstone, all of this stuff was laid down in a period of about a year by the receding waters of Noah's flood. And they claim that there's some geologists here, I can see people doing this. They claim that they can prove this scientifically. clearly this does not work scientifically. Let's just take a look at the Grand Canyon portion of this diagram here for just a moment here. So, okay, you get the 4,000 feet or so of strata of the Grand Canyon that's laid down, but then you have to cut Grand Canyon. Then you've got to carve this huge ditch in the ground. How do you do that? Well, catastrophic geology. This is a diagram from a book by Steve Austin. They believe that a huge lake with a vast amount of water, six times the amount of water of the Great Lakes, broke through catastrophically, kind of like this channeled scablands, you know, up in Montana, catastrophically broke through an impoundment of some sort and sluiced down and cut Grand Canyon in a period of about a week or two. Geologically speaking, this has got problems. One that maybe you could tell right away is you have all this soggy sediment, right? And you're going to run this huge amount of water through it. Why would it just cut it? Why wouldn't it just wash it all the way to California? You know, and if you did manage to cut it, why would these walls stay like this instead of going kerplop? Because remember, this is all very mushy and squishy, and this has just been laid down by this huge big flood. You know, scientifically, this stuff doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Their model doesn't make any sense, and more from the standpoint of science, there's a lot of evidence against it. Just as a little quick, for instance, by the way, the National Center for Science Education has a Grand Canyon trip every summer. It's really warm down there. I should encourage you to consider coming with us. It's really warm down there. This is January in Alaska. It's warm. But here we are looking at a slab of Coconina sandstone. Now, I was mentioning that the Grand Canyon has these layers, you know, 4,000 feet of these very easily identifiable layers. The Coconina sandstone is this, you know, layer that's probably, as in many places, as tall as this building. I mean, it's a big chunk of sandstone. Scientists, geologists who have studied this will tell you that the Coconina sandstone was deposited by air. Okay, some layers like limestones and siltstones are deposited by water. Most sedimentary deposits are deposited through water, most sandstones. Certain kinds of sandstone showing certain kinds of bedding like the Coconino shows, which we can study in extant beds that are being formed, the aeolian deposits by wind. Certain kinds of sandstone we know were laid down by air. So the problem with the creationist model of having the whole Grand Canyon laid down in one swell foop like this over a period of a year is that you've got thousands of feet of layers of water laying rock, and then you've got this big layer of wind laying rock, you know, and then you've got a whole bunch more layers of water laying rock on top of it. How does this work? Does the flood suddenly stop? Okay, bring in the wind, and a whole bunch of wind come in and deposit the sand. This is absurd from a scientific standpoint. If you want to believe that God created the Grand Canyon and left all the layers in and made it exactly like he did, fine, you can believe that if you want. You know, a lot of theologians would disagree with you, but you can't show it through science. Once you start saying, we can prove this scientifically, okay, you're playing on science's turf, and we can provide evidence that refutes this. And remember, this is what creation science is doing. It's not saying, this is just a religious view, leave us alone. They're saying, this is science, and we should be teaching this science alongside the science that you teach in high school. If you're going to call it science, we got to talk. It doesn't work.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Dr. Scott's talk on the evolution of creationism was recorded on January 27th at the UAA APU Consortium Library.
Okay, we've been talking a little bit about science and religion here. I want to point out that there are many sources of analysis of the creation science position, okay? Creation science claims that it is a scientific point of view. There are very large numbers of books which deal with both the science and the religion, as it were, of creation science. analyzing the scientific arguments and refuting them. If you go to a very useful website called talkorigins.org, you can find the responses to virtually any creationist argument that you might come across in the blogosphere or left leafleted to you in your mailbox. Now, I want to point out that within the creationist literature, they have something they call the two-model approach. And this is, I want to go over this because it keeps showing up. It's the logic behind creationism in general. They believe that there are only two possibilities. There's either evolution or there's special creation. Remember, they have a very dichotomous choice you have to choose. So if you disprove evolution, well, what's left? Special creation wins by default. They don't have to go out and show evidence for everything appearing all at one time in its present form. They don't have to show evidence for Grand Canyon being deposited by a single event. All they have to do is disprove evolution, and they win, because this is a dichotomous choice. Now, when you think about this, this is not a very good logical position, mostly because on that creationism side of this argument, there's more than one option. For example, there's something called theistic evolution. Now, some of you may have gone to Catholic high schools. If you went to a Catholic school, this is what you learned. At Catholic schools, they routinely teach evolution happened, the planet changed, plants and animals shared common ancestries, humans share ancestry with apes, evolution happened, and this is the way God worked it out. God is involved, but evolution happened. It's a position called theistic evolution. There are many, many variants of theistic evolution. The Catholics have a slightly different version than the Episcopalians, have a little different position than the Methodists, but, you know, it's the basic theology of mainstream Protestantism and Catholicism. The special creation biblical literalism is only one part of American Christianity, and not the majority, by the way. But, you know, you don't have to just be Christian-centric, as it were. There are many more religions out there than just Christianity. There are world religions like Hinduism, and disproving evolution doesn't prove Hinduism any more than it proves special creationism. There also are tribal religions of not only Native Americans, but people around the planet. There are ancient religions, disproving evolution doesn't prove the Greeks and Romans were right either. There are lots of options here over on the creationism side, so it simply is illogical to say that disproving evolution proves special creation. It doesn't prove anything. And actually, if they ever disprove evolution, then there'll be something interesting to explain it, but it probably won't be one of these arguments here, which are all mutually exclusive. So, in the 1970s and 1980s, there were lots of efforts to try to get creation science taught in local school districts and get state laws passed that would require equal time for creation science and evolution. Arkansas and Louisiana passed equal time laws, and the Louisiana case eventually made it all the way to the Supreme Court. The case was Edwards versus Aguillard, and it was heard in 1987. And the Supreme Court struck down these equal time for creation science laws on the grounds that they violated the First Amendment. These laws were designed either to promote the theory of creation science that embodies a particular religious tenet or to prohibit the teaching of a scientific theory disfavored by certain religious sects. In either case, the act violates the First Amendment. Public schools have to be religiously neutral. They cannot teach as fact sectarian religious views, or any religious views, or anti-religion. And they don't. Now, during the time that the Edwards case was making its way up through the courts, during the early and mid-1980s, a group of conservative Christians began to be disillusioned with creation science. They could see that it was legally vulnerable. They could also see that by making all these fact claims about the age of the earth being 10,000 years old and Grand Canyon and so forth and all these other claims, that these fact claims could be refuted, and so that weakened the position, of course. But also, the fact that creation science was so tied to biblical literalism meant that you're not going to be bringing in very many Catholics on this. You're not going to be bringing in very many mainstream Protestants. So this group of conservative Christians were trying to figure out how they could come up with another kind of anti-evolutionism that wouldn't be, it wouldn't have the shortcomings, as it were, of creation science. The book that's on top of this stack, a book called The Mystery of Life's Origin, is considered by many of the intelligent design proponents to be the founding book of their movement. In this book, which is about the origin of life, Thaxton et al. Made the argument that, yeah, the origin of life is a really difficult scientific problem. There is not at this point a consensus of opinion among scientists as to the step-by-step process through which you get from inorganic chemicals to organic ones, although we know a lot about that part, getting from organic chemicals to something that's enclosed within a membrane, although we know a little bit more about membranes, getting something that replicates within that membrane. You know, there's all these pieces, is it metabolism first, or is it replication first? There's all kinds of things that we have to learn. It is a very difficult scientific problem. These guys go one step further. It's not just a problem that we haven't solved. It's an unsolvable problem. They're making the argument that the complexity of that first living thing is a class of scientific problems that they've created that is insoluble by natural causes. It requires the infusion of intelligence in order to explain this kind of phenomenon. Well, the intelligence spells its name with three letters, and the first is G, okay? Although they don't mention that in the book. They just talk about intelligent causes necessary. There's a lot of, you know, let's not talk about it in the intelligent design literature. The creation science people are much more upfront about they're talking about God. As Dean Kenyon said in the foreword to the book, it is fundamentally implausible that unassisted matter and energy organized themselves into living systems. Now, this is very familiar to anybody who knows a little bit of history of science. There was a watch lost in the hall. Will Mr. Paley please come by? the historians chuckled. William Paley was a 19th century clergyman who wrote a wonderful book which had a lot of natural history in it. It was called Natural Theology. And even if you've never heard of Paley, you've probably heard of the watchmaker analogy. If you were walking along a heath and you happened to see a stone, you wouldn't think twice about it. Stone might have been there for millions of years for all you know, perfectly natural thing, uncomplicated, no big deal. But if you saw a pocket watch on the heath, you would know because the pocket watch consists of all of these bits and pieces and springs and wires and glass and stuff, all of these pieces that are fit together so cleverly. It's an artifact that allows you to measure time. You would know from looking at this, the complexity of this pocket watch, that there had to be a watchmaker. You would not think like a rock that this was a natural item that just happened to come together as a result of natural causes. So then he had the analogy that if you look at a very complicated thing in nature, such as the eye of a vertebrate, which is the same eye that you have, you're a vertebrate. If you look at the eye of a vertebrate, it's a very complicated thing. It's like a little machine. It's got all these layers and lenses and nerves and vessels and all of this stuff that is very cunningly fit together in this complex fashion to bring light to the brain. If you see something this complicated in nature, you know there has to be an eye maker. The book Natural Theology was an apologetic. It was an argument for the existence of God as a result of looking at his complex structures. Okay? Very popular book. Darwin loved it. What Darwin ended up doing, however, is turning the argument from design, which is what Paley's position is here, turning this kind of on its head and basically doing away with it as a scientific principle. I mean, it was a theological principle. But what Darwin did was look at something complex like an eye and many other examples of complexity in nature and say, you know, you can build this through a step-by-step process called natural selection, which I'm writing about in my book here, and you can actually build things that are very complicated through the process of natural selection. He came up with a natural explanation for what Paley had said could only be explained by the direct hand of God. That was kind of interesting during Darwin's day when he presented this, is that Christian theologians kind of sat back and said, huh, well, that's kind of interesting. What do we do now? And they didn't say, well, we quit believing in God. What they did was they said, well, you know, we did okay with Newton. When Newton came up with the idea that God uses gravitation to bring the planets around the sun, you know, you didn't have to have angels out there guiding the planets around the sun. God obviously created gravitation, so fine. God can work through secondary causes here, too. And that was the basic mainstream Christian explanation for how you could still, you know, still keep a God involved in the process. But basically, natural selection is a natural way of building complex things. This is not agreed with, of course, by the intelligent design folks. Now, structurally speaking, I view intelligent design as really a subset of creation science. In other words, it's the smaller set. What I mean by that is that certainly in creation science, you get things like age of the earth arguments, you get flood geology, you get all these other claims. And the intelligent design people don't talk about that at all. So there's a lot of stuff in creation science that's not, you won't find that in the intelligent design literature. But if you look at the intelligent design literature carefully, and those of us who have studied it can give you evidence for this, everything that is promoted in intelligent design pre-existed in creation science. There's really nothing new, including the beloved bacteria flagellum. That also came right out of creation science. So the basic idea of complexity requiring the direct hand of God, requiring special creation, the impossibility of evolution producing complex structures, that's right out of creation science, comes eventually from William Paley, but it is the essence of what intelligent design is. Now, William Dembski is a foremost theoretician of intelligent design, and he has defined intelligent design as being, one, a scientific research program that investigates the effects of intelligent cause, two, an intellectual movement that challenges Darwinism and its naturalistic legacy, and three, a way of understanding divine action. Well, two and three are certainly interesting, but they don't have anything to do with science. They're philosophical and religious arguments. We'll have to just look at this claim of Dembski's that intelligent design is a scientific research program that investigates the effects of intelligent causes. Well, what is it then? Well, it's kind of thin, to tell you the truth. There are really only two ideas in intelligent design: Michael Behe's argument of irreducible complexity and William Dembski's own design inferences, sometimes called specified complexity. Now, Dembski says that irreducible complexity is a subset of his idea, but nonetheless, they basically deal with the same general concern, which is that really, really complicated things cannot be explained through natural causes, require special creation, require the intelligence, and it's obviously a supernatural intelligence, not a material intelligence, to produce. This is kind of it, guys, when it comes to the science of intelligent design. Michael Behe uses the analogy of a mousetrap to illustrate what he calls irreducible complexity. This is the idea that you have structures such as a mousetrap which are functional only when all of their component parts are together. So here's a mousetrap, it has five parts: catch, spring, hammer, hold on bar, platform. According to Dembski, you have to have all five of those parts all together before you can catch mice. Otherwise, you just have a piece of wood with some metal on it. It is irreducibly complex. When he came out with this idea in the 97, I think it was, a number of scientists thought, that doesn't make any sense. And if you Google, as some of you do, Dembski and mousetrap, you will find that there was a cottage industry of producing reduced mousetraps that are really quite amusing. Here's a four-part mousetrap. Here's a three-part mousetrap. Here's a two-part mousetrap. And there's even a one-part mousetrap where I guess the mouse is supposed to impale itself upon the... But, you know, nobody said they had to work well. You just have to start out with something and then, you know, tinker. Because that's what evolution does. Evolution tinkers. And the whole point of making reduced mousetraps and kidding around with Dembski, might not really be complex, but the whole point is to illustrate the idea that something that looks like it's irreducibly complex might actually not be so. Let me just sort of walk you through this a little bit. The argument that Behe makes is that evolution, natural selection, couldn't produce an irreducibly complex structure because evolution has to have a selective advantage for each link in the chain, so to speak. To put this piece together with that piece, you have to have a selective advantage. If you don't have a selective advantage until all of those pieces are together, you can't have this evolve. This piece has no selective advantage to link with that piece, therefore can't happen. That piece with that piece, that piece with that piece, so forth and so on. The idea is that you can't build these structures incrementally. It only works when you have all the pieces together at one time, or so it's said. Now, scientists have looked at this argument and thought, no, that's not really how natural selection works. You don't really get it when it comes to the power of natural selection. For example, there could very well be situations where you had a component which had a function doing something in the cell, for example, and it could be combined with another with some other proteins or molecules or enzymes, which would produce a modified function, and only at the end was this combined into something which looked like it was irreducibly complex, because you only came in at the end. You didn't see the prefab, so to speak, along the way. This is only one argument against irreducible complexity. The woods are full. There are a lot of reasons why irreducible complexity is not being taught over in the biology classes. It's because it has no scientific warrant. If you wanted to look at this in terms of the beloved mousetrap, similarly, if a mousetrap consists of five parts, if you only had three parts, you could make a very handy tie clip. Or some really painful earrings, if you only had a spring and a platform, you could make an attractive paper clip. And if you just had the hold down bar, well, you could make yourself a fishhook or perhaps a rather unpleasant toothpick. But the point being that components of a supposedly irreducibly complex structure could have evolved for other purposes and been combined at various stages of evolution to produce something that only looks like it's irreducibly complex at the end. Another point that was made by a number of evolutionary biologists is that if you look at the examples that are chosen by the intelligent design proponents as demonstrating irreducible complexity, there are all these molecular ones which don't leave much of a fossil record. Okay. Actually, there is when you compare related forms, but that's more sophisticated than we're going to talk about tonight. If you look at the mammalian middle ear, or if you look at the wrist bone of birds, these are irreducibly complex structures, and we have beautiful fossil records showing gradual transitions. But they don't talk about those. They talk about the things we don't have fossil records for. Intelligent design proponents often claim that new genes can't evolve because new information, which they don't define very well, can't occur without the infusion of intelligence. Well, they act like there isn't a very large research program investigating the origin of new genes. These are actually articles from a couple of years ago. There's nothing especially noteworthy about this. There's a whole subdivision of biology looking at the evolution of new genes. There are well-accepted procedures like exon shuffling, lateral gene transfer, gene fusion and fission, duplication. It's like the intelligent design people ignore all of this biology there, which refutes their point of view. Schematically, what the intelligent design people are saying is that irreducible complexity, or in Dembski's terms, specified complexity, which deals more with probability, can either be the result of chance, of natural selection, or of intelligent design. Well, nobody thinks that chance produces the vertebrate eye. I mean, nobody's arguing that you know, these things come together by chance. The intelligent design people say that natural selection can't do it either, so therefore, intelligent design explains irreducibly complex structures. Well, most evolutionary biologists would say, not so fast on the natural selection part. We think natural selection is perfectly capable, and other evolutionary mechanisms, of producing the kinds of variation that can result into very complex forms. But even without that, I hope you will consider that this is a very bad way to reason about science. Consider that this is an elimination algorithm, so to speak. A doesn't work, B doesn't work, we win. What if there's some other mechanism we don't know about yet? Right? You're claiming victory without any evidence for your position because you claim to have eliminated two other possibilities, forgetting there might be something. How many people here are from the science departments? Raise your hand. It's okay, I won't call on you. Keep your hands up, boys and girls. Okay, there's quite a few of you. All right. How many of you from the science department? Oh, actually, raise your hands if you're from the science departments. Go ahead. No, leave them up. How many think we have answered all the questions there is to know about science? Keep your hands up. Dang, look at that. There's not a sink. That's the whole point. This might be looking familiar to you. I hope it is, because remember we talked about the creation science two-model approach in which you disproved evolution, therefore you proved special creationism. Well, watch. Oh, my. It's the same reasoning. Disprove evolution, and you've proved intelligent design. It wasn't very good logic before. It hasn't improved in 20 years. Now, mainstream Christian theologians, as well as scientists, by the way, have been very critical of intelligent design and creation science. This is more of a science lecture than anything, than a theology lecture. But I do want to call your attention to the fact that there's a wide range of books out there dealing with predominantly Christian theology. Looking at the arguments of intelligent design more from and creation science more from a theological point of view, including some, by the way, from an evangelical Christian perspective, such as Carl Giberson's Saving Darwin, Dennis Lamoureux's I Love Jesus and I Accept Evolution. This guy is an evangelical. He's a wonderful man. He's a good friend, but he is really an evangelical. I mean, he is evangelical about persuading his fellow evangelicals that you can still be an evangelical Christian and accept evolution. And, of course, Margaret Towne's Honest to Genesis. So if you're interested in the religious aspects of this, you might consider these points of views as well. Also, the BioLogos Forum, which was started originally by Francis Collins, an evangelical Christian scientist, and the American Scientific Affiliation, the website for which is ASA3.org, are places to go on the web for information about how evangelicals look at evolution. The evangelicals at BioLogos and most of the evangelicals at the ASA accept evolution. These are very worthwhile sites particularly if you yourself are a conservative Christian. All right, so what happened to intelligent design? Well, in 2005, I should say in 2004, the school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, passed a policy requiring that teachers teach intelligent design. A group of parents sued the administration because they did not want their kids to be taught religion in science class. There was a full trial in federal district court. The judge decided that intelligent design was not science. It was, in fact, a religious view masquerading as science, and it was unconstitutional to teach it, and awarded court costs of $2 million to the plaintiffs, none of which NCSE got. Full disclosure here, NCSE acted as an advisor to the plaintiff's legal team, the parents' legal team. It was a fascinating experience. To see where we are now, I want you to take you back a half hour or so ago to the Edwards versus Aguilar decision, the one that struck down creation science. Justice Brennan wrote that decision, and he wrote that it would be okay for teachers to teach scientific alternatives to evolution. Of course, this is the claim that intelligent design made. Well, we're a scientific alternative, we can be taught. We know what happened to intelligent design. But the predominant creationist strategy today was actually stimulated, shall we say, by a dissent from Justice Scalia in this same decision. Justice Scalia said that the teachers should have a right to teach the evidence against evolution. And the evidence against evolution approach is what I want to talk about now, because this is bringing us full circle to what we have today. Now, remember the pillars of creationism, okay? The evidence against evolution argument is a lovely combination of the first pillar that evolution is bad science, and also the third pillar that of fairness, let's teach both, let's give everybody equal time, and so forth and so on. During the last decade or so, we have seen in state science education standards and policies proposed at the state level and school boards and legislatures a number of proposals for criticizing evolution, presenting the evidence against evolution in some context. The wording for these kinds of policies is very interesting. Critically analyze evidence for evolution is a common phrase that we've encountered. Sounds reasonable. We should be able to critically analyze anything, so what could possibly be wrong with that? Trust me on this, or don't trust me, go to NCSC's website and read the news reports. Critically analyze doesn't mean critically analyze. Critically analyze means criticize. This is the context of these policies. Teach the evidence for and evidence against evolution. Well, if you were to go over to the science department and say, I'm a teacher, I'm getting ready to teach evolution, and we have this new law in my state, Mr. Biologist, Mr. Dr. Geologist, would you please give me the evidence for evolution and the evidence against evolution so I can go out and teach it? And the biologists and geologists will give you the evidence for evolution, but you know, we actually don't have a list of evidence against evolution because there isn't any. Teach the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. Similarly, you're not going to be able to go to the science departments and say, can I have a list of the weaknesses of evolution? We don't know what you're talking about. This is sort of like going up to the astronomy department and saying, can I please have the weaknesses of heliocentrism? You know? The astronomers are really not arguing about whether the planets go around the sun. You know, this seems a done deal in the astronomy department. Whether living things have common ancestors is not being argued about in the science departments. Now, we do argue a lot about the mechanisms, about the patterns of evolution. We argue a lot about the details, because that's what science is all about, arguing about the details, and coming up with the big ideas, too. But the big idea of common ancestry, huh? You know, we're not fighting about this one. You know, ask me about whether birds are dinosaurs. We can argue about that. But whether, you know, whether birds and dinosaurs had common ancestors, no, that's silly. Evolution is theory, not fact. That's a time-tested favorite. Well, of course you should teach evolution as theory. Theories are so much more important than facts. Sure, when a scientist talks about theory, a theory for us is an inferential explanation. Theories explain laws. They explain facts. They are the most important thing in science. They are what science is all about. If you can come up with a theory that stands this test of time, you can die happy, okay? Teach evolution as theory, not fact. That's not what they had. What I was talking about is not what they have in mind. What they have in mind is use the word theory like they do on the street, as just a hunch or a guess or something that's very easily dismissible. Teach the full range of views about origins is another phrase that you find in these policies. What they mean by that is slip in a little bit of creationism when you think no one is looking. Now, the top-down approaches, like the Dover policy or the creation science equal time laws, those run into the First Amendment. The courts strike those down. They don't seem to work. The current approach is to work from the bottom up, so to speak, rather from the top down. There were a number of cases in the 1990s, largely, of teachers who were teaching in districts where they didn't have an equal time policy, but they just decided to go ahead and teach creationism anyway. And their district said, knock it off. And they said, nope, I'm going to sue you for my free speech rights, for my academic freedom rights, to teach what I think is good science. And the court says, that's nonsense. Newsflash, there is a big difference between being a K-12 teacher and being a college professor. A college professor has a lot of academic freedom. A K-12 teacher has hardly any. If you are a kindergarten through 12th grade teacher, you sign a contract in a district, you have agreed to teach the district's curriculum. You can't just teach any old damn thing you want. You have to teach what the district's curriculum is. And the district says, no, we're not teaching creationism here. That's unconstitutional. Stop doing it. And so these Pelosa, Levesque, and Webster lost their cases. The new creationist strategy was inspired, in my opinion. They didn't call me up and tell me this, but this is what I think is happening. I think they looked at the cases of Webster, Pelosa, and Levesque and thought, the polls show about 30% of teachers out there would like to teach creationism if they had a chance. So rather than having top-down policies, let's free the teachers to do this. Let's give them, and let's package this as academic freedom rather than packaging it as bad science, which is what it really is. Let's package this as free speech and academic freedom, because, you know, raise your hand if you're against academic freedom. Of course not. Everybody's for academic freedom. Couch it in the language of critical thinking. Raise your hand if you're against critical thinking. Nobody's against critical thinking. So these policies are very cleverly written. An example of this approach is a Florida Academic Freedom Act, as they've been called, that came up a couple of years ago. State Senator Rhonda Storm submitted it. And it gives teachers the right to teach creationism. A district cannot punish a teacher for bringing in alternatives to evolution. There's various ways of phrasing it, but everybody knows we're talking about creationism here. It prohibits administrators from cracking down on the teachers, and it also leaves the door open for students to promote creationist views in their assignments. The teachers did not want this bill, believe me. That is not something that the majority of Florida teachers thought was a good idea. Fortunately, this bill did not pass, but it got pretty darn close to. A similar Academic Freedom Act did pass in Louisiana, however. If you go to a website, academicfreedomact.org, you can find a sample policy and this wonderful, you know, the packaging of these ideas is just brilliant. You know, remember the fairness pillar, right? Fairness, free speech, openness, everybody express your ideas. This is as American as apple pie. This so keys right into American culture. This is, they can't win on the science, they're going to win on the culture. At least they can try to do it this way. Let me teach. Why can't I supplement my science classes with current articles and balanced discussion? Here's a little linguistic tip, my friends. Whenever you're dealing with a website or any literature that deals with creation and evolution and the word balanced shows up, it's a creationist site. You know, dollars to donuts, this is the way it works. Let me think, says this cute little girl. Why can't I be allowed to decide for myself what the truth is? Oh, that'd be interesting. I guess there's face validity on that. I probably don't need to develop that. Nonetheless, these Academic Freedom Acts have been sprouting up like little mushrooms or toadstools for the last several years, and not always in states in the Deep South. Iowa, Michigan, Maryland, in some places that are a bit surprising. You know, the people who promote these bills know exactly what they mean. The people who support these bills know exactly what they mean. They're trying to sneak in creationism through the back door. They failed in the courts when they were up front with it, so let's see if we can, you know, package it as critical thinking and free speech, and maybe we can have some success there. So, let me summarize. Creation science begat intelligent design. They had their days in the sun, and they're still around. I mean, creation science is a major player, believe me. They still are out there. They are doing nothing but expanding their reach. The Creation Museum up in Kentucky is a big deal. There's creation museums cropping up all over the place. This is not a movement that by any means is dead. It is dead in terms of a strategy of trying to be taught along with evolution in the schools, because they lost that one from the courts. But by no means are they a culturally dead movement. Intelligent design hasn't done much lately, but they've been pushing these Academic Freedom Acts. They have written some sample legislation. and are definitely promoting a textbook that they wrote called Explore Evolution as just the kind of book that you would have to buy to supplement these new materials that teachers are supposed to bring in given these Academic Freedom Acts. After the Edwards versus Aguilar decision, the one striking down creation science, there was a two-way branch, shall we say, of strategy. One branch arguing for the teaching students the evidence against evolution, the other branch arguing for teaching alternative theories to evolution. Now, of course, if you ask the science community, what are the alternative theories to evolution? You will be met with confused looks. If you ask the proponents, it's intelligent design and creation science, even if they don't necessarily call them that. If you ask the science community, well, what is the evidence against evolution? They cannot bring it forth. But if you ask the proponents of these laws about the evidence against evolution, the literature that they provide you comes directly out of the intelligent design and creation science movements. So basically, the evolution of creationism really has, like all evolutionary systems, shall we say, been an example of adaptation to the local environment. In this case, it's the legal environment. And we've also had adaptive radiation, if you will, when certain paths are closed off. We've had the adaptive radiation into intelligent design and evidence against evolution, and these lineages are going quite strong today. Thanks so much for coming to hear me tonight.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Dr. Eugenie Scott presented The Evolution of Creationism at a public talk she gave at the UAA-APU Consortium Library on January 27, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.